This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
BFM 89.9, you're listening to The Morning Run with Lynn-Mark Roshan-Kennison and Noelle Lim. It's 6am, Thursday the 16th of July, or as one of our producers likes to call it, Friday Junior. How are you both doing today?
Every morning now, I have to think about an answer for that question.
You got to keep it varied, right, Noelle?
Yes, you have to constantly innovate, right? So I think it's as good as it can get on a Thursday.
I'm giving you an opportunity to wax lyrical about your very exciting life, Noelle.
Yes, indeed.
I think the only one waxing lyrical early this morning is you, Lynn. But let's take a look at... I'm actually a bit amused because I'm taking a look at football scores this morning. And Arsenal beat Liverpool 2-1. It doesn't matter at
you
this point.
You can talk to yourself now,
yeah,
right?
Yeah.
You know,
this is the morning monologue when I'm talking about football. But essentially what this win does is it ensures that Liverpool doesn't break the 100-point record set by Manchester City all those years ago. But I'm just amused. Like, when we need Arsenal to win it in a game, they win against Liverpool when it doesn't matter. It's just weird. But essentially, everyone's just fighting for their third and fourth space because the top spot and second spot have already been taken by Liverpool and City. Everyone's just vying for that Champions League spot at this point. Again, I see just puzzle faces in the room. I'm just going to move on.
You've got to tell Noelle and I like whether congratulations or commiserations are in order because we're not quite certain.
Thank you for that summary. I'll just have to repeat that and sound intelligent when I meet my football friends.
Absolutely. But nevertheless, you know, we do have a lot of things lined up for you as well today. So later on, after the 6:30 news, what are we talking about?
Well, we'll be taking a look around the world as we do at 6:30 a.m. News around Hong Kong's role as the financial capital of the world, as well as a bit of back and forth between Anthony Fauci and the White House. A few months ago, he was a hero. Now, maybe doesn't seem as much. That doesn't seem to be the story as much.
And before that, we have something else that's quite interesting happening at about 6:15. What is going on, Noelle?
Yes, that will be a local piece of news, and it's something to do with aging.
I always look forward to the way Noelle forward sells her that what we're going to talk about in about 15 minutes. It's always I always try to predict how she's going to go with it. I'm not disappointed.
Well, hopefully you aren't either. You can let us know what you think. You can WhatsApp us 018-789-8899 or tweet us at BFM Radio. Up next, we're talking about education, since yesterday was the first day that a lot of schools opened. We're asking the question of what are some of the other ways to help kids get an education during the COVID-19 era. So stay tuned, BFM 89.9. BFM 89.9, you're listening to The Morning Run with Lynn, Roshan and Noelle. That was Dire Straits with Sultans of Swing. And now we're taking a look at the subject of education, because today's the 16th of July. Yesterday, schools reopened, I think, for most of the students who have been out of school for about 4 months now at this rate. There was also coincidentally an article in Fast Company looking at, you know, some alternative ways that schools and educators can adapt to kind of the new social distancing needs that have suddenly cropped up as a result of COVID-19. Now, this article talks about potentially, you know, transforming the streets around schools into learning centres as well. And it's an interesting idea, particularly since I think... I don't know about you, but I happened to be driving yesterday around the time that schools were finishing, and there were quite a lot of students clustered together at bus stops, and you know, it just kind of raised some worry for me that we might see another burst of infections coming from our school districts.
So I think in the short term, and in you know, places like the US and UK or Europe where it is cooler, you could do that, right? You know, taking into account the streets, using the streets as places for children to incorporate that as part of their education, to be there physically. But there are also all these issues about safety, security, being outdoors, and also provided there's no heat wave, right, then that will really complicate the situation. But you know, I can imagine after 4 months of, you know, doing online education, some teachers may be quite anxious to get their children ready for exams if there are any major public exams. So I think the idea sounds good, but in the short term, I'm not sure.
Yeah, no, I don't know about going outdoors, especially, it's been really rainy recently. I don't know how that's going to play in to the Malaysian context. We have heat waves are one thing, rain is another. And
tropical country, like extremes of weather.
Yeah, you know, not a great idea. But I think, the idea is the social distancing element, right? So maybe there's other infrastructure that you can use, especially with events not taking place like they used to. Maybe the school hall, maybe other event spaces, or you just split the school in half, right? You have half the school come in one week and the other half. These are all logistical nightmares, all of them. But these are the logistical nightmares that we have to face, I guess, to find a workable solution. Because it is, I can't imagine what it's like to just work, as a kid, to be in front of your computer and only use that as your only source of education. I have seen kids who are dealing with this, and it's very confusing. And you don't really want to ask any questions. At least, you know, when you're in the classroom, you can ask your friend, like, oh, hey, I don't understand what's going on. Can you tell me? You know, because you don't want to look like you don't know what's happening in class in front of your classmates, right? Or at least, at the very least, you can put up your hand in a physical arena and the teacher will notice you. How does a teacher notice a kid online when there are 40 people on screen?
Yeah, so members of my family have been doing distance learning, you know, during the MCO and the RMCO up until this point. And yeah, I've had complaints like particularly the younger kids who are not so technology savvy. If they have a question, they find it difficult to ask the teacher because the teacher has, you know, the teacher has a Zoom enabled in a sort of a participant mode. So they, you know, the students' mics are muted. If they click the raise hand button, the teacher may not necessarily see it. So they just kind of have to sit there in stunned silence as they get further and further lost. Unless, of course, a parent happens to walk by and say, like, you know, how's it going? Or do you need me to call your teacher? So technology doesn't solve every problem. And that's, of course, assuming that you have access to a working internet, right? What struck me about this idea in Fast Company wasn't so much specifically taking education out into the street, although, you know, the whole new meaning to street smart kind of did strike me as kind of funny. It was the flexibility and kind of the modular nature, that modular approach that they're taking to education in COVID-19. You know, and I wondered whether we could take that and apply that in our own educational context. I know that the Ministry of Education came out with several different methods and ways for schools to return to full operation. So I think most of them have gone with the one session route. But I just wonder, you know, whether there are other perhaps opportunities that we can see and we can capitalize on, particularly since, as you said, Roshan, you know, most people still aren't occupying large event spaces and that kind of thing.
Yeah, so I think in the short term, the priority seems to me is to get back to sort of that pre-COVID
some
normalcy.
Semblance of normality. Yeah,
yeah, but with all these SOPs in place and just making sure children are okay and, you know, they can just move along their studies. But really, I think this poses a longer term question about education, right? The direction of education. Is it preparing children for the future, for jobs that won't exist, that don't exist right now, right? So, it may be too soon to say, you know, it's an opportunity to revolutionize education because people are just so bogged down with other priorities right now. But really, you know, education has a lot been about download and learn. Yeah, just download and repeat what you downloaded. So, you know, there has to be something about knowledge creation, right? So going into the streets, using other infrastructure, tapping into all that other resources. It's going to be part of education, I feel, you know, in the next 10 years, 5 to 10 years.
Yeah, I think on-demand education isn't the best thing for kids. It's one thing to do it in college or university when you are supposedly an adult and have the ability to kind of know the consequences of your actions. So if you don't study, that's on you. But when you're a kid, you don't understand consequences. I didn't understand when I was 9 years old or 10 years old, or even when I was 13, I think. But there has to be a way to have that contact with teachers in one way or another.
So let us know what you think about this. You can WhatsApp us 018-789-8899 or tweet us at BFM Radio. We've got some messages coming up for you. And then up next, we're taking a look at the fact that Malaysia is turning into an aging nation. So stay tuned, BFM 89.9. BFM 89.9, that was Stoned Love by The Supremes, and you're listening to The Morning Run with Lynn Roshan and Noel. 6:20 a.m, Thursday the 16th of July, and apparently Malaysia is heading into being an ageing nation. So this is a report coming out of the Malaysian Statistics Department, which said that the percentage of our population aged 0 to 14 has declined slightly from to 23.3% compared to 23.5% in 2019, while at the same time, we also saw a slight increase of the percentage of the population aged 65 and above. Now, this is an interesting phenomenon that is not just limited to Malaysia. I mean, countries like Spain and Japan have already been trying to weather this issue for years. I think I saw a statistic a little while ago that said one person ages out of the workforce in Japan every minute, almost. And it was recently another article in the BBC saying that some 23 countries in the world will see their populations halve in just a few years by 2100, half of their population. So the question is, you know, what do we do about this? You know, as a country, aside from some governments, you know, trying to encourage people to have kids, and Singapore's done doing this, is there something that we can do in terms of infrastructure to prepare for an aging nation?
I have no idea. Sorry about that. You look at the things like aging population, the biggest concerns come about from things like retirement funding, mm-hmm. or even the other one is, I think in terms of Malaysia, will be the pension funds for government servants as they retire, because it's incredibly heavy on the government coffers. These are the concerns. But I mean, globally, we're seeing the fertility rates come down, right? We're seeing people overall having less kids, and for good reasons. Things like women getting education, getting in the workforce, having the right to choose what they want to do with their lives. I don't know what we want to do about this. I think, you know, we often talk about how the world is overpopulated. Maybe this is the natural way of kind of over time tapering it down. Now, to a country's economy, there are severe repercussions in the short term or medium term, right? Because the younger generations are going to have to basically prop up the economy and a smaller population with a top heavy situation. But at the same time, with healthcare the way it was and people living longer, did we expect anything else?
Yeah, so I think from a policy point of view, the government is presented with a few choices. One, it loosens its immigration policy, allow more foreigners to come in, either at the expatriate level, professional level. I think in the case of Malaysia, we love foreign workers. So that's one option. Two, another option is to really make sure your healthcare, your public healthcare mm-hmm. system is good. Private healthcare remains affordable, maybe even looking at insurances, encouraging people to take up insurances so that it's not too late, right, by the time when they need those medical insurances. And then I think then thirdly is the retirement funds, how we want to manage that. I think in Japan, it's already in a situation of net withdrawals. So EPF right now is in a very lovely position where it can, you know, it's just got money coming out of its ears, right? It's just getting more and more money every year. But at one point, the situation will be reversed and they'll be paying out more because people are retiring. So for Malaysia, I think a few, 2020 was said to be one marker. 2030 has been also said to be another marker, where 16% of the population will be above 60 years old. And so that's what they consider as really like aging, like, you know, becoming more aged. And so, yeah, so the challenges are always this, where the young will have to work harder. And also another policy to consider is how do you ensure people who are able to work, maybe above 65, can still work. So I think in Singapore, they had some schemes where they encourage SMEs to engage very mature professionals who have a lot of experience, but, you know, don't want to work in that full-time arrangement anymore. And so they encourage SMEs to, you know, take on some of these as consultants, as advisors. So that's one way to sort of, you know, ensure that the talent pool still, you know, continues to circulate.
Yeah, I think at one point as well, last year, if I remember correctly, the Pakatan Harapan government at the time was talking about potentially raising the retirement age from 60 to 65. And I think that was to partially combat the fact that, yes, Malaysians are living longer. And with the retirement age set at 60, if you consider the fact that our average kind of rate of mortality. You know, the average lifespan of a Malaysian citizen is about 74, 75. That is 15 years that the average person goes without an income in this day and age. And we've also talked a lot about the fact that EPF is not enough to sustain someone over the entire course of their retirement until their death. So what other, you know, what else do we need to do, or what other policy measures do we need to introduce in order to, I guess, cushion the transition into being an aging society? You can let us know what you think about this. You can WhatsApp us 018-789-8899, tweet us at BFM Radio. We've got the 6:30 news bulletin coming up for you, but first, Mr. Jones by The Counting Crows, BFM 89.9. BFM 89.9, you're listening to The Morning Run with Lynn Mark, Roshan Kanison and Noel Lim. That song was Toxic Girl by The Kings of Convenience. And speaking of toxic behaviour, if we take a look over at what's been happening on social media, Twitter particularly, I think there's been some interesting things happening on that front, haven't there?
Yeah, if you notice a lack of tweets from us this morning, it's because we can't tweet out this morning. There seems to be a massive hack on Twitter. And this really is related to basically, big influential individuals like Barack Obama, Joe Biden, Bill Gates, and Warren Buffett, including companies like Uber and Apple. Their accounts were hacked, and they tweeted out a tweet basically asking for money in the form of Bitcoin. So if you look at Bill Gates, his one was, "Everyone is asking me to give back, and now is the time. I'm doubling all payments sent to my Bitcoin address for the next 30 minutes. You send $1,000, I send you back $2,000. And then there's a Bitcoin address, and only going on for 30 minutes, enjoy. This has all the trademarks of a scam, right? Because there's a time crunch, there's a exorbitant return involved, or in these other situations, it's normally a punishment if you don't do something. This, we were talking about it in a BFM webinar a few weeks ago. And coincidentally, today on Ring It and Sense, we'll be talking about cybercrime. I'll be talking with Citos Holdings Group CEO Dennis Martin about this, because they're looking into this as a credit rating agency. But you know, these are certain things, right? If you don't know, don't share. I think that's rule number one. And if it seems too good to be true, it probably is not true. And if you don't, like, especially if people call you and give you a time crunch, normally there's a bit of a, it smells bad, you know, that there is a, it smells funny. Take a minute to call back the appropriate number, especially if banks call you for your personal information.
Yeah, so, but interestingly, Trump's tweets have not been hacked. Quite interesting there, I thought. So anyway, Twitter, they are now preventing verified accounts, like you mentioned, including BFM, from even tweeting at all, starting, I think, sometime around 6 a.m. our time. And I think this will be the first time Twitter has ever done this in their history, right? And so I think the chaos began when Elon Musk's Twitter account was compromised by a hacker intent on using it to run a Bitcoin scam, and then after that followed by Bill Gates's account.
Yeah, there are a lot of very big names involved in this. I mean, Jeff Bezos, Kanye West, Apple, Michael Bloomberg.
And the tweets vary, right?
They do. It's not just a cut and paste. It's so Bill Gates's was, you know, everybody's asking me to give back, so now I finally am, right? Kanye West is, I'm giving back to my fans. So it's really targeted at all of these
and it's a highly coordinated effort, right? For them to target this many highly influential people on Twitter with big names and verified check marks, which kind of gives you the illusion of trust there, mm-hmm. that they are tweeting themselves and all of that. This is big news for Twitter. I don't know. I wonder how they're going to handle this issue. If you look at the social networks, Facebook was dealing with its own problems with in terms of speech, right? And then here now you have Twitter. You got a security issue. A few months ago, Zoom had its own issues. This is the digital age, and this is the concern that comes with the digital age. That said, Noel, you brought up the point about how Donald Trump's Twitter account wasn't hacked. I wonder whether it's just they didn't want to essentially wage digital war with the president of the United States. Yeah. I wonder how the cyber command of the U.S. would take to that kind of attack.
You're going to feel
attack.
The entire weight of the U.S. government on you.
Especially since Twitter seems to be the president's favorite mode of communication.
Yeah, because it's official. It really does seem like official communique from the White House a lot of the time. So I wonder, in a hypothetical situation, how would the US government respond to something like that? That is, I'm going to be thinking about that today.
But, you know, In terms of other things that we're wondering how the US government is going to respond to, the situation between the US and China also appears to be heating up, because China has come out to say that it'll sanction US institutions and individuals after President Donald Trump signed an executive order and a new law that basically revoked Hong Kong's special status. And this is in the wake of course, the new national security law that was passed in Hong Kong that a lot of, I think, that a lot of people and a lot of Western democracies protest against, because they viewed it as infringing on Hong Kong's freedom of speech and democratic institutions.
I mean, what's a international talk set at 6 a.m. in the morning if we don't talk about the Cold War between the U.S. and China, right? This is just ongoing. Every day there's a response back and forth. It plays out in the papers. It plays out in the media streams. And really, it's just about, I guess, both countries want to look good to the constituents that they are targeting, right? And the U.S., I think, is targeting in this situation, there's a little bit of targeting of the international community, but also Trump just wants to look strong as well, I guess.
Yeah, so, you know, the situation is getting ugly, right? So I think the FT also ran this piece of story. Google, Amazon Web Services and Microsoft have refused to agree to a proposal that will give Hong Kong regulators access to customer banking records. So what they're doing, so these companies are going out against Hong Kong government to say, no, we're not going to share with you our customer data because, you know, that will breach the trust between they have with customers, right, with their clients.
Yeah, I think there's a lot of fear surrounding what Hong Kong's new kind of operating environment is going to be like. I think the New York Times also came out to say that they're going to be moving their Hong Kong staff to Seoul over fears of that operating in Hong Kong may no longer have the same press freedoms as it once did, which also kind of raises the question of, I wonder whether South Korea is going to be the beneficiary of this debacle in Hong Kong.
Yeah, I guess, you know, when you look at freedom of speech, I mean, we often overlook South Korea as a model of a democracy in this part of the world, right? Coming from where they came from decades ago, I mean, they were the first nation to have an election in the pandemic era, right? Mm-hmm. And they did it well, they did it organized, and they really insisted on having their rights, their democratic rights fulfilled. So I wonder if Korea benefits from this in the longer term. I mean, there's also Tokyo that's around the region. It's been a big hub for a long time. The money will move eventually. It's just the status of Hong Kong, of what we're used to it changing. And I guess we'll only have to see how this plays out.
Absolutely. But do let us know what you think. You can WhatsApp us 018-789-8899. Tweet us at BFM Radio. We have some messages coming up for you, and then we're going to be taking a look at what's happening on the front pages of our newspapers. So stay tuned. BFM 89.9. BFM 89.9, that was Sheer Mag with Just Can't Get Enough, and you're listening to The Morning Run with Lynn, Roshan and Noel. 6:50 a.m, Thursday the 16th of July, we're taking a look at the main stories across our newspapers and portals today. And I think one of the biggest that caught my eye was on Malaysia Kini, the fact that the four-term slim state representative, Muhammad Kusairi Abdul Talib, passed away yesterday at the age of 59 due to a heart attack. And tragic news, and his death will also pave the way into the 12th by-election that the country has seen since GE14.
Yeah, as you mentioned, Lin, he was a four-term assemblyman for the slim state, and he was once chairman of FINAS as well. And we're going to be looking at our 12th by-election. That is quite a number there. So if we take a look back at 2018, he retained the seat at that point with only a 45% of the vote, with a Bersatu candidate at the time coming in with 33%, and then followed by PAS 22%. This is going to be an interesting by-election to watch, because right now these are all three parties are basically on the same side at this point, and this has led to PKR saying that they will be contesting for the seat. I'm interested to see if PKR can make any headway in here, because by all measures, this looks to be essentially a Barisan stronghold, an UMNO stronghold. And I think any edge that PKR can get here will be a win for them, considering that it's traditionally... this is what Bersatu and UMNO and Tun Mahathir keep saying, right? That PKR cannot contest these seats. So let's see whether they can.
Yeah, so I think pretty much also depends on the timing of the by-elections. I think a win for PKR is unlikely, given that it's an UMNO stronghold seat. But if they could swing some popular votes to them, well, then it's good for them. But
yeah, it's a litmus test, right?
Yeah, but I think given the current situation where people are just so concerned about bread and butter issues, yeah, I think the priorities right now are not about human rights and reforms. It's rather that will I still have a job?
So can PKR then talk about that, right?
Yes.
Especially with Parliament in session now, can they address these issues? Can the opposition bring up enough economic? It's all about the economy. It always comes back down to this. We look at the US economy. When push comes to shove, these people think about their wallets. So can you cater to that narrative?
Yeah, so of the 11 other by-elections that we've seen since May 9th of 2018, I mean, obviously the lines have shifted somewhat, but six of them went to Barisan Nasional, five of them went to Pakatan Harapan at the time. So I guess we'll have to wait and see. We'll be watching this very closely and bringing you
only
updates.
Only five parliament seats, right?
Yeah, only five. We'll be bringing you any updates as we get them ourselves. But if we take a look at other stories from the papers this morning, so the Star has back to school, back to good old fun on their front page, along with a picture of students in class still having, you know, having a little bit of a good time, it looks like, because pupils did return to school for the first time since the MCO began in mid-March yesterday.
If my watch is correct, I think kids should be heading to school right now. And my advice to kids is I was passing some schools yesterday and they were all crowding around the bus stops, which gave me a bit of anxiety around the whole situation. But the plus side was they were all wearing masks. I couldn't spot a single person who was not wearing one. So good on you, but maybe try and keep that physical distance there. If I take a look at Malaysian Reserve, which I have in front of me, the SME Association of Malaysia, President Dato' Michael Kang has said that some industries have benefited from COVID-19. Essentially, the essential services have grown. Now, if we take a look at the SMEs, they provide about 907,000 SMEs in the country, provide close to 6 million jobs, which cover around 65% of the workforce. Now, the problem here is that 89% of those total SMEs are in the services sector, such as retail, tourism, and logistics. These are the sectors that were, particularly the retail and tourism, those were the ones that were hit very hard by the pandemic. But if you look at things like healthcare, F&B in some cases, and technology, they have gained somewhat in the pandemic era.
Yeah, so I think looking at this piece of news on Malay Mail Online, Tourism Minister, Malaysia's international arrivals set to plunge 75% from 2019, simply because, well, the borders are closed. And so that's quite a big loss, because I think the tourism sector contributes something like 14 to 15% of our GDP, around that figure last year. So it's a big hit for our country. And also back to the news about, you know, children returning to schools. There's this rather disturbing piece of news here by Sina Harian, and it's on its front page. And it is saying that some teachers have to fork out their own money to buy masks and sanitizer, because apparently the masks that are allocated to schools have been insufficient. And so I think QPEX is hoping that the government will step up to allocate more masks, and also for companies to provide sponsorship.
Yeah, that is quite disturbing news, particularly since, the teachers are amongst some of the people who will be most exposed if there is some kind of infection outbreak in any one of these schools, because they're jumping from class to class. All effort needs to be taken in order to keep our teachers as well as our students safe during this time.
Yeah, and not everyone can afford a mask, right?
Absolutely, especially in places where if they are a rarity and you still see prices being hiked, despite the fact that, of course, the government has come out to say you're not supposed to do this, particularly during a kind of a time of emergency. So it's very unfortunate news indeed. The Star, though, also has another education-related headline here, 15% reduction on non-tuition fees, and I think this came out of the Ministry of Higher Education yesterday, but students are saying it's not enough, reduce it further. So these are, I think, the fees have been quite a sticking point for a lot of people, particularly as students haven't been able to access campuses up until this point in order to try and facilitate their education.
Yeah, I had a breakfast grill with Beacon House CEO, I think it was last week, where they reduced their fees during the MCO, but I think going forward, that's not going to be the case as they see as things start to hit full force again.
All right, and that is all of the news that we have for you this morning, because we're about to head into the 7 o'clock bulletin. But after that, don't go away. We have more business news and analysis coming up for you. Be sure to stay tuned. But first, here is the Family Stone, Sly and the Family Stone with Soul Clappin', BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.